welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot, first of all, for inviting me. And so far, I'm really enjoying it. And yeah, so this is work from this year. And this year is the rough outline of what I will talk to you about today. So first, I want to give you some general background of all these different concepts that make up my title, so matrix product states and this idea of reinforcement learning. Then I will introduce our control framework and then go over a couple of different examples where we apply it to different state preparation scenarios. And then finally, I will also very briefly tell you how you can integrate all of this in your NISQ device simulations. Okay, but before we start, I first kind of want to give you the big picture or the main idea of what we are trying to do here. So we are tackling the problem of quantum many-body control. And this is pretty much essential for most modern quantum technologies. So if you, for example, want to simulate some condensed matter system or some molecule on your quantum computer or some simulator, then you usually first have to prepare the ground state, for example, on your physical device. So this is the problem of state preparation. And the idea is usually that in your experiment, you start off with some state that you can easily prepare. So for example, a spin polarized state or the ground state on your quantum computer. But you want to end up in a certain target state that you then want to investigate further. And then the problem is that you have to come up with some sequence of gates or unitaries that evolves you from your initial state into your desired target state. And coming up with such an optimal protocol of gates is usually already quite challenging and requires you to perform some kind of optimal control algorithms. Now, the thing is that these quantum technologies that I've been mentioning here, they are nowadays really built on harnessing many interacting spins, particle, qubits, et cetera. And whenever you are in this many-body domain, you have this one big problem that you're probably all familiar with, namely your Hilbert space dimension grows exponentially with your system size. And this makes it very quickly infeasible to classically simulate your many-body wave function exactly. And of course, if we cannot efficiently simulate it, it's even more difficult to come up with control strategies thereof. And so this is what we are trying to tackle in our work. And for this, we propose a new control framework. And on one hand, we will be using reinforcement learning as an algorithm that performs this optimal control task. And I will tell you later in detail how all of this works. And then we will also enhance it with matrix product states. And we use matrix product states in two different ways. So one is kind of the conventional natural way of using it to compress the quantum many-body wave function so that we can efficiently simulate it. But we will also use matrix product states actually as a trainable machine learning ansatz for our reinforcement learning agents so that we can also efficiently train. And our full framework can probably be summarized by this figure here. So we will always represent our quantum states as matrix product states. And this optimal protocol of gates will be devised by some machine learning agent, which by itself will also be represented by a matrix product state. Okay. And now I want to give you the background. So I first will start with what matrix product states actually are. So MPS were originally developed in this condensed matter community for simulating quantum many-body systems. So imagine you have some system that lives on a lattice. Let's say you have a chain of spin 1/2 to keep it simple. Then you are always able to represent the wave function as a rank n tensor. Which means it has like n legs, one for each different spin or one for each different side. And I will always use this tensor diagram notation to represent a tensor. So in this case, we have this square, which represents our wave function. And it has these legs sticking out, which corresponds to each of the indices that this tensor has. So we have one for each of the spins or sides. And now you can decompose this huge rank n tensor into a collection of n rank 3 tensors. So these are these tensors A's here, or in this equation, it looks like this. So each of these tensors now just have 3 legs. One leg still corresponds to the physical index, and the other 2 legs correspond to these virtual index that we sum over, that we contract over. This is where the matrix product comes in. And these virtual indices, they also have some dimension associated to them, and this is called bond dimension. I call this chi here. And if you now count the number of parameters we have in this ansatz, you will find that we get away from an exponential scaling in our system size n to something that now looks like it's only scaling linear in our system size. Okay, and maybe a few more words about this bond dimension. So the bond dimension actually has a nice physical meaning, Namely, you can relate it to the amount of entanglement that is shared between two subsystems across the corresponding bond. So basically, the larger the bond dimension, the more long-range entanglement your system can capture. And you can also make this a bit more precise. So you can, for example, prove that matrix product states are efficient for so-called area law entangled states in 1D. What does this mean? So this means that the entanglement entropy does not scale with your subsystem size. And this then, in turn, you can also show that your bond dimension does not scale or does not have to scale with your system size. And then you are really back to this true linear scaling for which everything is efficient. And if you're not familiar with these area law entangled states, so they are actually precisely the ground states of local gapped Hamiltonians in 1D. So they are very interesting, important, you know, little corner of our many-body Hilbert space. Yeah, and finally, I think I should also mention that matrix product states come with like a huge toolbox of different algorithms that let you efficiently calculate ground states, time of all of your systems. You can calculate correlation functions and whatever you want. So they are a very powerful numerical framework. Okay, and since recently, matrix product states have actually been also used for machine learning, so in a completely different domain. And I very briefly want to highlight a couple of different examples of how you can incorporate them into your machine learning models. So here in this first example, this was by Miles Taulmeier and David Schwab. They considered this typical problem of MNIST classification, so classifying handwritten digits. And as a model, they actually chose just a simple linear model. So you have your classification output vector, then you just have a linear weight matrix. These are the parameters you're optimizing. And then you have your input. But instead of directly mapping your images as is, they instead first mapped all of their images to some higher dimensional embedding of feature space. So something that you might be familiar with, like these support vector machines or these kernel methods. And in particular, if you're interested, there are different ways of how you can do this mapping. So they took each of the pixels of an image and just mapped it to a vector or to like a spin 1/2 degree of freedom. And if you do this for all pixels in an image, you actually end up with like a huge tensor product of, you know, spin 1/2 particles, essentially. And then again, in this tensor diagram notation, you can now represent this equation in this form. So the input will be this quantum state, this tensor product of spin 1/2 pixels. And then you have this weight matrix that maps from this higher dimensional space to your classification outputs, to the probabilities. And now what they did is, instead of having this huge weight matrix that scales exponentially in your image size, they instead represented it as a matrix product state, which then had far fewer parameters. And then they just optimized these tensors locally one at a time, essentially. There are also different ways of how you can use matrix product states. So you can, for example, take your, you know, conventional deep neural network, as you know and love it, and you can simply represent the weight matrices in this neural network as matrix product states, or in this case, actually, as matrix product operators. And in this way, you can compress the neural network weight matrix, essentially. And then finally, another example is to incorporate in some kind of hybrid architecture. So here, for example, they try to do some quantum machine learning. So they had some parameterized quantum circuit and also a trainable matrix product state ansatz. And in this case, they use this matrix product state to like as a dimensional reduction technique. So to extract some features of their input data, and then they only input these latent representation that they got into their to their quantum computer, quantum circuit. And this idea is actually very similar to also what we will be doing later. Okay, so this was my very brief introduction to matrix product states. Now I will switch gears and come to reinforcement learning. Also, of course, if there are any questions, always feel free to interrupt me and ask. So reinforcement learning is one or belongs to one of these three main branches of machine learning. And reinforcement learning in particular tries to solve control problems. Or you can also think of it as trying to win at games. And there are a couple of really famous examples that you probably have heard of. So people at DeepMind at Google trained a reinforcement learning algorithm to play this highly complex board game Go. And this algorithm was actually able to beat the world best human player at that time. And I think it's still beating the world best human players. The same people also applied reinforcement learning to video games. So here, an agent learns to play the video game of StarCraft. But you can also apply reinforcement learning to like classical control problems. I don't know, like teaching a robot how to walk or run, for example. Okay, so in this reinforcement language or framework, you always have two different entities. So on one hand, you have the reinforcement learning agent. This is kind of like this abstract entity which makes decisions, somewhat like our brain. And then on the other hand, you have the reinforcement learning environment. And this is the actual physical system that you are trying to control. And then you take whatever problem you want to solve, and you usually discretize it in time. And then at each time step, the agent can observe the current state of the environment. So in terms of this board game, this would mean the actual, you know, board game with the precise location of all the tiles on the board. And then depending on this state information, the agent then chooses to perform a specific action. So again, here this would mean that the agent takes one of its tiles or stones and places it on one of these grid cells. And of course, such an action in turn changes the state of the environment. And then on top of the state information, the agent also receives a scalar reward signal at each time step. And this reward should kind of guide the agent to perform better and better actions. So it kind of reinforces good behavior. And the goal, of course, is to always maximize this reward signal. And in fact, what you're trying to do is you try to maximize all future cumulative rewards. And you try to do this by always acting optimally, by always taking the optimal action in each state. And there are different reinforcement learning algorithms that you can use to solve such a control problem. The one that we use is so-called Q-learning. This is also a very common and famous algorithm. And I very briefly want to tell you how this Q-learning algorithm works. It's a bit complicated, and I don't have time to explain you all of this in detail, but I hope I can get at least the main points across. So in Q-learning, you're trying to learn so-called optimal Q-values. And these are defined as the maximum expected sum of future rewards if you start in a state S and you take a specific action A. Okay, so these Q values somehow encode the reward structure of your environment, in fact, like the best possible reward you can expect. And now the nice thing about these Q values or these optimal Q values is that if you have properly learned them, if you know them, you can always infer what the optimal action to take is in each state. Because then you simply look at the Q value in your state and you take the action that maximizes your Q value. Okay, so instead of directly learning the optimal actions, what you're doing in Q learning is that you indirectly learn these optimal actions by first learning these Q values. And there are different ways of how you can optimize these Q values. Usually what people do is that they first approximate these Q values via some parameterized function. And nowadays, if we hear parameterized function, this is usually synonymous with neural networks. So this would be a Q-value network. And a Q-value network would take as an input the state of the environment or some representation of that state. And then it outputs one Q-value for each different action you can possibly take in this given state. And then again, by looking at this output, you can then figure out which action is the optimal one to take. And then finally, how do we optimize this thing now? So how do we optimize these parameters? And this is something that you just have to trust. So you can actually write down a loss function for these Q values. And if you minimize this loss function, then you are guaranteed to get closer and closer to your optimal Q values. Yeah? I think there is. So first of all, what I've drawn here is actually a Markov decision. So what this actually ends up being, this kind of feedback loop that you have here, is actually a Markov decision process. And there is some math behind it. I'm not 100% sure because I have never really looked into it, but I'm pretty sure that there is something behind it. Yeah.
Just for the people online, the question was Markov chain math.
Let me, I think if you look in the Sutton book, There's the Bellman equation and all that, in there. I think there's this. I think the answer is yes, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great book to kind of learn the basics from.
Okay. So one final background slide. So I also want to show you once how this whole algorithm would actually work in action. So how you would do the learning. So as I already said, at each time step, the agent is able to observe the current state of the environment. With the state, you then figure out what the Q values is by this Q value network. And from these Q values, you can then decide which action to take. So you can take the action that maximizes your Q value, or you can, for example, take a random action if you want to explore different possibilities. And then depending on this action, your environment is transitioned to the new state and you get a reward signal. And each of these transitions, they will be stored in the so-called replay buffer. And you can think of this as your training data set. And then once in a while, you will sample a mini batch of these transitions from your replay buffer. And then you will minimize this loss function over this mini batch. And in this way, optimize these parameters in your neural network. OK, so this is how the training works. And this was my last background slide. If there are no more questions, I would go to our control framework. Good? Perfect. Yeah, before I get there, though, I want to mention that we are, of course, not the first people who apply reinforcement learning to, like, problems in quantum physics. So reinforcement learning has already been used for quantum state preparation, which is also what we consider in our work, also for quantum error correction, quantum circuit compiling, quantum metrology, and the list goes on and on. But what most of these applications so far have in common is that they focused on controlling only very few interacting particles, spins, qubits, etc. But as I told you, quantum technologies nowadays have like much, much more qubits, and we also need control strategies that can deal with this increasing number of particles. And this is where our work comes in. Okay. And to kind of introduce our control framework, because we are using reinforcement learning, I want to define how our agent looks like and how our environment looks like. And I will start with the environment because this nicely sets up the control problems that we are trying to solve. Okay, so we will consider controlling a chain of spins, a spin one halves, but it doesn't really matter. And as the reinforcement learning state, we will actually take the quantum state itself. So at each time step, the agent has access to the full quantum state information. But because we want to do many-body physics, we will always represent our quantum state as a matrix product state so that we can do stuff efficiently with it. Next, in terms of the actions, we will always evolve our quantum state according to some unitary time evolution operator. And this generator here of this time evolution, this operator A, these are the actions that our agent can choose. So we have a discrete set of, in this case, let's say 6 different actions. And our agent at each time step can choose one of these operators, and then we evolve our state according to this unitary and get to the state at the next time step. And then finally, what is our reward? And again, to remind you, so we want to prepare a specific target state. So one very natural figure of merit that you might want to maximize is the fidelity between your state and the target state. The thing is, though, that these overlaps actually vanish exponentially in your system size. And this would make it very difficult for our agent to learn if the overlaps or the fidelities are zero most of the time. So instead, what we are doing is we actually take the log and also scale with the number of particles. And in this way, we have something that is a bit more guiding to our agent. OK, so this is roughly our control scenario. I will give you particular examples later where we look at preparing different target states. But now I first also want to introduce you the agent. And because we are doing Q learning, our agent will spit out a Q value, right? And the Q value will depend on our reinforcement learning state, which in our case is the quantum state. So this is our input to our Q value network. It's the quantum state, which is already represented as a matrix product state. And actually, it turns out that it's very natural now to also have a matrix product state as an ansatz for our Q value network. So these squares that you see here, this is another MPS, another matrix product state, but this has nothing to do with our quantum state. These are just parameters that we will optimize as we train. And this computation that I've drawn here, this is actually nothing but computing the overlap between our input quantum state and this trainable MPS, what we call QMPS, Q value MPS. And yeah, finally, this QMPS, this has an additional tensor here in the middle with this dangling leg, which means that when we do all of these contractions, we actually get a vector out. And then we take this vector, and we will feed this vector through a small feed-forward neural network. So we actually also have a hybrid architecture of like a neural network and a matrix product state. And the output of this neural network, we then interpret as our Q values. Okay, and the nice thing about using a matrix product state on that in this case is that the resources for, you know, evaluating and training it actually scale only linear in our system size n. And this is, of course, only true as long as, you know, these bond dimensions, this feature vector dimension, the number of training episodes, and all of these hyperparameters, as long as these don't scale with the number of spins or the system size. But this is exactly roughly also what we found. So we were able to choose all of these hyperparameters roughly independent of our system size. And this nice feature, of course, stands in contrast to, you know, approaches where you would just use neural networks and would train with a full wave function, because then you would automatically have to, you know, input an exponentially large wave function into your neural network, and all your resources would automatically scale exponentially in your system size. Okay, and then finally, how does training work in our case? So we will always train in episodes, and we will start each episode from some, in principle, random initial state. And then we will let the agent and the environment interact. So the agent will choose to perform some actions, and the environment will return some states. And then we will continue this in this way. And then we say that once we hit a certain fidelity with respect to our target state, let's say a fidelity of 0.99, then we say that we have successfully prepared our target state. And then we would terminate an episode and then reset and start from a new initial state and repeat this all over again. Okay, so this is how our algorithm, how our control framework works. And now I want to show you how it actually performs in action on a couple of different examples. And we consider the problem of state preparation, and more specifically, we will do ground state preparation. And as some easy toy model example, we just consider the mixed feed easing model. So this mixed feed easing model has some spin-spin interactions, and then it has some transverse field and some longitudinal field. And just to remind you of how the phase diagram looks like, so if you are in the case of negative coupling strengths and zero longitudinal field, then you will have a phase transition between a ferromagnetic phase and a paramagnetic phase. And if you're in the opposite regime of positive couplings, then you will in fact get a critical line that separates an anti-ferromagnetic phase from a paramagnetic phase again. And now what I will do is I will pick different points from this phase diagram and define some kind of control scenario around them, just so that we have some examples to test our framework on. So in the first example, I will try to prepare this specific ground state of our model, starting in fact from arbitrary random initial states. The second example I will skip because we don't have time. And in the third example, I will try to prepare a state on the critical line of the mixed feed easing model, starting from ground states of the model, but with opposite coupling interaction strengths. Okay, so let's start with the first example. So again, to remind you, here we are trying to prepare this specific ground state from our transverse feed easing Hamiltonian, starting from randomly drawn initial states. The thing is, if you are in a many-body Hilbert space and you take like random states, they will in principle be volume law entangled, and volume law entangled states we cannot represent with a matrix product state. This is the first problem. The second problem is, again, if you have a volume law entangled state and you want to, let's say, disentangle it, then in principle it requires you exponentially many gates, or exponentially many gates in your system size to disentangle the state if you just have local gates available. And this is, of course, also not feasible. So for this particular example, we had to restrict ourselves to a fairly small system size of just 4 spins. And of course, you can say now, for 4 spins, we don't need matrix product states. You know, you can do everything exactly with the full wave function and your conventional neural networks. But the problem that we are trying to solve here, this universal state preparation problem, this is highly not trivial. And so we take this specific example as like a first benchmark of our QMPS framework to see if it's expressive enough to solve such a complex task. Okay, and once I also wanted to show you how a representative learning curve looks like. So what I'm plotting here is the average fidelity you get at the end of an episode as a function of the training episode, so as training progresses. And initially, you see that the fidelity is rather low, which means our agent is probably just doing random stuff and doesn't really know what it's doing. But then this fidelity is kind of increased, and at some point we hit this gray dashed line here. And this gray dashed line is exactly the fidelity threshold that we set for this particular problem. And then in the insert here, I'm showing you the corresponding number of episode steps, so the number of actions or unitaries that our agent applies to reach the target state or reach this fidelity threshold. And you see that initially we always require like 50 episode steps. And in fact, what I did is I always truncated each episode after 50 steps. So if the agent wasn't able to prepare the target state within 50 steps, I said, nice try, but please try again, and I restart from a new initial state. But you see that very quickly the agent is actually able to prepare the target state, and it learns to prepare it in fewer and fewer episode steps. Okay, yeah?
Why is the agent motivated to do it faster? Because this, the number of episodes is not part of your loss function, right?
No. But so the reward, if you remember, the reward was the log fidelity, right? And the log fidelity is always negative. So actually, what we are doing at each time step is we are not rewarding our agent, we're actually punishing our agent. And so the agent actually has an incentive to reach the target state in as few steps as possible to not accumulate a large negative reward. Yeah. Yes, so the reward you get at each time step, yeah. Okay, and now given this, that this worked or looks like it worked really, really well, we now want to test it on a couple of different initial states, right? We trained it on random initial states, so whatever initial state we give it now, it should be able to prepare the target state from there. So here's an example. Here we start from a Z-polarized state, and in the upper plot, I'm showing you the actual protocols, the actual actions our agent applies to get to the target state from there. So in the first three time steps, we apply these single qubit Y rotations, then we apply some of these entangling gates, and so on and so forth. Until the episode is over. And in the lower panel here, I'm showing you the corresponding fidelity, so how the fidelity changes as we apply all of these actions. And we start off with some low fidelity, and then the fidelity is kind of maximized until we again hit this gray dashed line, our fidelity threshold. So in this case, it works. But now we can test it on all kind of other initial states, and you will find that in each of these examples, it still works. So here, for example, we start from some anti-ferromagnetic easing ground state, here from a GHZ state, and here, in fact, from like a random state. And in all of these cases, our agent is able to successfully prepare the target state. And this is really something that conventional optimal control techniques usually cannot do. So if you take like a conventional technique such as, I don't know, CREP, GRAPE, or your favorite Cypher optimizer, then usually what you're doing is that you have one initial state, one target state, and you optimize to get the specific protocol for this scenario. And as soon as you want to start from a different initial state, you have to rerun your whole optimization. But in this case, we actually only optimize once, and then we get all of these optimal protocols for free, okay? Good, so this was our first example, and this worked really well. Now I go to the last one. And again, to remind you, here our goal was to prepare a state on the critical line of this mixed feed easing model, starting from paramagnetic ground states of the model with opposite coupling strings. So kind of what we are trying to do here is connect ground states of two different Hamiltonians. In this scenario, you for example, often find in quantum simulator platforms where your actual physical system is controlled by some Hamiltonian, but the system that you want to investigate further is given by a different Hamiltonian. Then you have to connect the two ground states. The thing here is that in this case, we also only did 16 spins. The reason is that we are actually trying to prepare critical state. Critical states have huge system size dependencies, are highly correlated, so we weren't really able to get to much larger system sizes. But yeah, nevertheless. And now I want to show you results of an agent that we have already successfully trained. And I will again test it on different initial states, okay? So in this plot here, each point corresponds to starting from a different initial state, so different initial ground states with particular values of the longitudinal and transverse fields. So this plot here is essentially the phase diagram that we see here on the right. And the color in this plot corresponds to the final fidelity we are able to reach with our QMPS protocols. And during training, we set the fidelity threshold to 0.97, which means whenever you see like a bluish color, we were able to successfully prepare the target state. We surpassed the fidelity threshold. And whenever you see like an orangey color, it means that our agent failed in preparing the target state. But we in fact only have a couple of outliers here and, you know, the states in this ferromagnetic phase. So overall, it still works pretty well. And another interesting thing is that when we were training our agent, we were actually only training it on initial states that we sampled from this small enclosed region here. But now we actually test it on states that lie far outside of this training region. And you see that it still works. And this basically means that our agent is able to extrapolate these optimal protocols well beyond the training region, which is a really nice feature. Okay, and again, given that this worked so well, we wanted to see if we can push it further. And one thing that we wanted to study is how robust all of this is to noise, to noise being present in the time evolution. So now what we will do is we will, kind of randomize our time evolution. So remember that the evolution operator was always given by this unitary here. So A were the actions, were the operators that our agent chooses. And this delta T is something that I didn't tell you, but this delta T, this time step duration, is something that we actually fixed. So we fixed it to some value and we didn't optimize over it. The agent just had to live with whatever value we gave it. And now I will randomize this time step duration. So I will add some Gaussian random noise to it with some certain standard deviation. And now I want to show you how the results look like for one specific initial state. So here I'm starting from some initial ground state with these particular parameter values. And I'm plotting the fidelity as a function of the protocol time step. Okay? And in the beginning, I want you to only look at the red curve. So the red curve is what you get in the noise-free case, where we don't add any noise. So we start off with some smallish value, then the agent tries to, you know, maximize the fidelity, and eventually we hit the fidelity threshold. Okay, and now I will repeat this, and I repeat it 5 times, adding the noise with 5 different random seeds. And this then gives rise to these 5 bluish curves. And initially, the curves still overlap, but then eventually they start deviating a bit, which means that, you know, we get perturbed quantum states due to the noise. And then eventually, the agent will actually adapt the protocol. So it will take different actions than the ones we got from the noise-free protocol. But the nice thing is that even though we have this noise, in each of these cases, we were still able to prepare the target state. So this was just one particular example. We then repeated it for all of these different initial states. So here we do the plot on the left, but we add this noise. And you see that, again, overall, it actually still works really, really well. So our agent is, in fact, you know, robust to this kind of noise. And you can even say that the QMBS agent can, in fact, self-correct the protocols on the fly, like literally while your system is being time-evolved. Okay, and then, in the final 2 minutes, I want to briefly tell you how you can integrate all of this on your NISQ device simulations. So currently, our QMPS framework has one big bottleneck, and that is that the QMPS agent, so to calculate these Q values, to figure out which action to take, you have to calculate these Q values, and these Q values take as an input the full quantum state, right? And you have to do this at every time step. So this means that you have to perform quantum state tomography in principle at every time step of this algorithm, and this is, of course, very expensive. However, there are also ways of mapping matrix product states to quantum circuits or to gates on a quantum circuit. And this would then allow us to perform part of this computation and the expensive part of this computation directly on a quantum computer. So let's take, for example, this 4-qubit MPS here. You can exactly map it to this quantum circuit here on the right. So each of these tensors, each of these isometries with a couple of tricks, you can map them to gates or unitaries on a quantum circuit. And the output of this quantum circuit would exactly correspond to the state that was represented by this matrix product state here. And now we can do this for the optimized QMPS protocol, state that we got, and then perform this whole algorithm on a quantum computer. And this is how it would work. And this is also my last slide. So again, to remind you, how do we calculate the Q values? So the first thing that we have to do is we have to take our physical quantum state and compute the fidelity with respect to this QMPS, to this trainable parameter MPS. And then this fidelity is, you know, fed through the neural network. And there are different ways of how you can calculate fidelities on a quantum computer. So one way would be via sampling. So here I show you how you would do this if you would sample the fidelity. So you would first prepare your quantum state that you want to control, that you want to steer towards your target state. Then you would apply the inverse of your QMPS circuit, measure it, and then from these measurement outcomes, you can cook together what the fidelity was, and then feed these fidelity through the neural network and get the Q values out. And then from these Q values, you can figure out which action to take. Let's say the Q values tell you to take to perform like sigma Y rotations. Then what you would do is in the state preparation circuit here on the left, you would simply append a layer of sigma Y rotations, okay? And then you would repeat this and get in the next iteration, the next action, the next layer of gates that you have to apply. And then you repeat this until you have, you know, successfully reached the target state. Okay. And yeah, just to give you an outlook of other things that we did. So we then applied this QMPS circuit framework to this very first example I showed you, this universal state preparation scenario of four qubits. And then we looked, you know, how robust all of this is to decoherence, how robustly we can calculate the fidelity as a function of the number of shots, and yeah, different things. And if you're interested, I'm happy to talk about this more later. Then another thing that we looked at, which I skipped, was this specific state preparation scenario. Here the interesting thing is now that we really went to like a many-body problem. So here we are trying now to control 32 spins, which is clearly clearly beyond what you can do usually with exact techniques. And this also worked really, really well, actually. Okay. And yeah, finally, I want to thank my collaborator, Marien Bukov. And yeah, this was it. So thank you. And yeah, if you have questions.
Okay, let's go right to left in this row. Ready for this? Okay.
So I just have a question about what actions are available to the agent. It's a discrete set of like continuous Hamiltonians that it can operate under. Is this for fixed times? So are you evolving these Hamiltonians for a fixed time? Like, can you think of this basically as a gate model of a circuit as well?
So you can map all of these actions, of course, to gates on a quantum computer, but they are fixed. So they are, as you said, it's a discrete optimization problem. So we don't, like this time step duration that I was talking about when I talked about the noise is something that we fix. We don't optimize over it. It, of course, as like a future extension, it would also be nice to go to different reinforcement learning algorithms like policy gradients, which can actually deal with continuous actions.
Yeah, that was going to be my
follow-up. But at this point, it's all discrete.
Yeah, because I guess if you go to continuous, like it almost becomes like a variational circuit where you have continuous like variables you can optimize over. Like, would there be that sort of relationship between the two of them if you go to like the agent can choose how much time to evolve under?
In this case, so this is something you can also do with reinforcement learning, but it would require a different reinforcement learning algorithm, not Q learning. Yeah, with Q learning, you can only do discrete actions.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Firstly, thanks for the amazing talk. So my question is mainly about the Q function that you showed in the beginning and also in the second last slide.
Yeah.
So I understand that you find your optimal action by maximizing Q with respect to A, right? Yeah. And now, yeah. And so how do you compute your Q function? I think you mentioned that Q is like the future reward if you evolve under action A in state from state S, right? So I'm just wondering like how you compute future reward using Q.
Okay. So what you do is in this agent and this environment, they interact as part of the training. And you will kind of, as part of like this episode, the agent will see you kind of like all the future rewards, right? And then you kind of backpropagate this reward information to like previous Q values. So You go until the end of an episode, so the agent kind of observed all the rewards during this episode, and then you can kind of fit the final Q value at your final state to this reward. And then you can backpropagate this information to previous time steps. And actually, it probably makes much more sense if I show you the loss function. Give me 1 second. So in this loss function, what you are fitting is you fit the Q value. So this is basically your target. This is your label in like a supervised learning loss function, right? And this target is the immediate reward you get. So you are in state S, you take action A, and you get some immediate reward signal, plus the Q values or the Q value at the next state, at the next time step. And then if you go along these lines, you know, you kind of backpropagate the information of like previous Q values to your current Q value. This is how the learning kind of works.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Okay, thanks. Also, like one more small question. So you mentioned that I think like state preparation is not possible using classical optimal control.
What was not possible?
You mentioned that like state preparation is not possible using classical optimal control.
No, so no, it is possible. It's just that the specific scenario that we consider here, which is this universal state preparation, this is not something that is usually possible with optimal controls. And this is the reason is that we have this, we learn these Q values, and these Q values depend on the specific quantum state, right? So we are able to figure out what is the optimal action from any given quantum state. And this is something that you don't usually have with conventional optimal control techniques, right? You just learn a fixed protocol, and there is no state information in it.
Okay.
So here we essentially, so in reinforcement learning, this is called a policy. We learn a policy, we learn like a kind of like a universal protocol that tells us from each state which action to take.
Okay. Yeah, I think I get it. Thanks.
So I'm not an experimentalist, but this is a question that I think experimentalists like to ask, and I was wondering if this is applicable. I think oftentimes when you're doing state preparation, it's with a target Hamiltonian, and they often say, well, how do we know that this ground state is the ground state of this Hamiltonian that we're trying to prepare the ground state of? Do you see this being applicable to that? Because there's some information about this target Hamiltonian, I guess.
Yeah. So if you don't have the, if you want to prepare the ground state of some Hamiltonian, then you can in principle just change the reward function, and instead of maximizing the fidelity, you can just minimize the energy, how you do in like BQE and these algorithms. And this is actually also something we tried, and it also works. So you just have to change the reward function. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
The number of training episodes related to circuit depth of state preparation?
Yes. So in principle, the more actions or the more gates you need, the longer it takes to train, yes.
So, but can you comment about how the circuit depth depends on system size?
How the circuit depth depends on system sizes. Well, I think it really depends on the problem that you're trying to solve, right? So it could be anything between like exponential to independent. Like it really depends on the problem, right? Like what, from which initial state to which target state you want to go, what actions you have available. This is highly problem dependent, yeah. So in our case, we look at problems that are kind of like within this area law entangled area, and there the protocols only like very mildly depend on the system size.
Thanks. In my mind, the key difference between classical and quantum control is that in quantum control, measurements don't come for free. So in an experimental setup, you would have a state, and in order to know what you have, you need to kind of at least partially change it, right? So it seems to me that from a broad point of view, is there a way of incorporating this kind of measurement feedback into your state, or do you just assume that you know the quantum state at each point and you can get that information for free?
Yeah. So in this like how I introduced it here, you need the full quantum state. Like there's no measurement feedback. No.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for this very interesting talk. You showed, I think in the next slide actually, the sequences that your algorithm found. Yeah, this slide. Did you actually look into what the algorithm has done and you try to understand what it is doing? And then very similar, very related question, could you do what the algorithm has done? And if no, could you learn from those sequences?
So one thing that we did confirm is that we used, conventional optimal control algorithms, so like some sidepair optimizer, to actually check that these protocols, these specific protocols are, local optima. So in that sense, we were able to also get these solutions, but again, only for this specific scenario, right? And wait, what was the other question?
My question is more like, can you learn something from those solutions?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Can you, if you look at them, do you see, do you somehow understand the strategy that you could then apply by hand now to other systems?
Yeah. So we only looked at this for this particular problem here, and we were like, there was some really interesting structure. So it looked like a bit like these, you know, spinnaker or dynamical decoupling sequences where you do some rotations and you do like another rotation and you do the rotations back again. So it did discover some interesting sequence. But yeah, it's really difficult to learn anything more from, like, at least we stopped at there. We was like, okay, we understand what it's doing and it's doing the right thing, but we didn't look any further. Yeah, but I can show you later the actual protocols. Yeah.
Anna?
Okay, this is related to the previous. How does it scale? Guess it like this.
So I think as long as you prepare these ground states and stay with these area law entangled states, and in principle it should roughly scale linear in your system size. And again, this is also like especially this problem, like I checked it for different system sizes and I was able to keep all the hyperparameters, including the training episodes, roughly constant, which was really, really nice. Of course, if you leave these kind of class of states, then I can't answer the question. So the answer is, I guess it depends. Yeah.
Why don't you use a representation wave function? Why do you say
you? You could also do this. So instead of having this, having like matrix product states, you could use neural quantum states. I'm not sure how efficient this is, because then you have to also do sampling and things like that. So I'm not sure what system sizes you would be able to reach, but something that you can, yeah, you could do.
Thanks.
Yeah, I was wondering, as a follow-up to that question, could you train your model on a small system and then extrapolate sort of the control to a larger system? So you could like train on an 8-qubit or an 8-qubit system and then somehow use the agent to produce a control system for a 32-site system?
Not really, because part of the agent is this matrix product state, and the matrix product state, of course, depends on your system size, right? So if you train it on like 4 spins, then it will just have 4 sites. So you kind of have to figure out how do I enlarge it to get to like, let's say, 32 sites. And this is not something that is really trivial to do. And one thing that you can do is you can take the protocols you optimized for small systems and just apply them on the larger systems. In principle, they will perform a bit worse though. If you don't optimize them on the right system size, you are not able to achieve the same high fidelities as you would if you would directly optimize it on the large system sizes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions as I make my way down? If not, let's thank Rike again. Thank you very much. And let's